hello. This is the Sober Positive Workplace series brought to you by Show Up and Stay. I'm your host, Deanne Knighton. In one of my world-famous unsponsored plugs, I want to talk about a conversation I heard on the Flourishing After Addiction podcast, which is hosted by Dr. Carl Eric Fisher, who was a guest on this show. He was speaking with Dr. John Kelly. He is the first endowed professor in addiction medicine at Harvard, and he is also the founder and director of the Recovery Research Institute at Mass General Hospital. And this conversation touched on a very important area of interest for me and for our mission at Show Up and Stay to look at the recovery gap and that space after acute treatment where you've begun the process of healing from the substance to all of the pieces of the puzzle that are needed for long-term recovery. When you hear discussion about recovery treatment, it really is two buckets that operate very differently. Research supports that essentially the 12-week model that we have in place in our existing healthcare system for encouraging early remission, helping someone through the first stages of withdrawal potentially, and hopefully setting them on the stage for long-term recovery. That represents about 95% of the standard treatments that are available for recovery. However, there are many significant landmarks in the process of long-term recovery and sustaining long-term recovery and hopefully avoiding relapse. Mutual help groups like AA and 12-step programs have really been the go-to for a good part of history. Those groups grew out of necessity because the services that were needed to support individuals didn't exist. It's a story we hear time and time again, and although it can sometimes feel very disappointing, what happens is that these grassroots movements come out of the woodwork. Moving over to today's conversation, I wanted to have a guest that could speak to both the importance of considering how we apply the right amount of cultural sensitivity to the issue of recovery from substances and other traumas, but also someone who could speak to the importance of having safe networks, not only in our community services, but within our organizations. I needed someone with some hands-on experience to help us understand some of the building blocks that would be needed for an individual or group looking to build up a peer-driven, safe network within their organization. This is Dr. Masika Jordan Alston.
I was born in my mind, think I'm 21, so I won't give you a year I was born. But my father, when I was born, he was a blue-collar worker. It was sheet metals in the union. My mother and father, they lasted 4 years after I was born. They got a divorce. My mother, she was a police officer. My father had some injuries, so he would use drugs, and he had some background, too. Every single one of his siblings had a substance use disorder. Disorder is a funny word to call somebody that's struggling to live. They had these experiences. My father's father was a war vet and was addicted to alcohol. I remember him making moonshine in his bedroom that he would drink like tea every day, all day. And I loved them all, but my father had double-digit siblings. Every last one of them had a substance use experience. One of them committed suicide when I was in high school. My father, I watched die a slow death over a decade because he was diagnosed with pancreatitis and 10 years later he died. As his power of attorney navigating, I remember showing up at a hospital room, middle of the night. Nobody announces himself, well, I didn't, as Dr. Jordan Alston in the middle of an ER at nighttime, right? Like, I just show up as a daughter, and I'm not saying credentials, et cetera, because I'm not working in that capacity. I say, my father's power of attorney. My name's Masika, because I would have the pink sweatsuits or whatever, and my hair in a ponytail. And they would give me the look of disgust is what I felt like, because they thought that I wasn't worthy and my father wasn't worthy of better treatment. And so there were days that I had to say, I'm Dr. Jordan. And then automatically I would get a difference in their reaction. And I would speak their language and I would say, I need this, 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 and this. And the moment I showed up in a professional credential, I got the treatment I deserve. But it shouldn't have to be, because not everyone shows up like that.
I couldn't begin to read this bio to you today, but I am going to read a bit of it just to give you some insight into her amazingly rich background. Dr. Alston completed a doctorate of education in counseling and psychology in 2010. She is a licensed clinical professional counselor, a certified peer recovery specialist. She has many great accomplishments to note. CNN's Lisa Lang interviewed her on her work to promote entrepreneurship in marginalized communities. You may have also seen her work featured in the 2010 documentary film Waiting for Superman. Dr. Jordan Alston is an example of one of those individuals I mentioned at the beginning who saw holes in our system and did the best that she could to try and fill them. In addition to her work as a tenured professor, she is the founder of Jordan Peer Recovery as well as Peerfinity LLC, which she'll talk a little bit about on this episode. She has assisted over 50 agencies in 3 countries in developing various clinical, culturally responsive, trauma responsive, and evidence-based programs, including peer support programs.
I'll start with an overview of the work that we are doing. I say we because I feel like I've built an army. There was a statement that there used to be a war on drugs, and it's not a war on drugs, but it does take an army to create change. And that's what we're doing systematically. Our focus is on diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility for all so that all people can experience recovery. The way that we have done that and the way we started doing that was through peer recovery training. Just by definition, for people that may be listening that do not know what a peer recovery specialist is or a certified peer recovery specialist is, in different states, they're called different things. So if you go to New York, there's a title for it. Go to North Carolina, there's a title for it. Nonetheless, we are approved. Jordan Peer Recovery is in every U.S. state. So we did the work of getting approved through each certification board. Now, the technical side of this means the same way that a certified nursing assistant goes and gets trained, a certified peer recovery specialist goes and gets trained. Along with their lived experiences, they're able to sit through an examination in their state or either at the national level. Now, that training was existing before we started, but what I would go into rooms and figure out was that their training was happening, but there was a lack of cultural diversity in delivering the services. So if you happen to not be a middle-aged heterosexual white male that's in recovery, then some of the services may not have been written or developed for you. Now, that's not a slight against a middle-aged heterosexual white male. They need services too. Anybody that is struggling or trying to recover from a substance use experience, they need support. But where the market and the industry of human services had done a great job in helping one particular type of person, they had not done so well in terms of LGBTQIA+, in terms of Black, Indigenous, people of color, BIPOC, in terms of Latinx, in terms of people that have been incarcerated. It wasn't done as well.
When you hear the word peer support or peer recovery, it typically does mean that there's been some sort of certification put in place for that individual to reach back to people at earlier stages within a crisis and support them through that. It doesn't have to mean that, though. And many times that work is done without certification attached to it. This type of support is something that we see in community medicine and human services. But the idea and the concept is growing and is expanding and is applicable to essentially any group of humans that wants to create some sort of system within that group to be able to support the needs of those struggling with substance use disorder or maintaining long-term recovery.
So fast forward, what Jordan Peer Recovery has done today is set up a nationally approved and now international peer recovery training so that individuals like myself, like my father, whether you have direct experience or lived experience, can navigate the world of substance use experiences and connect with somebody that has a similar experience or similar story to yours. But we realized that some of the systems were not ready, and I'm not naming any specific hospital as the system that's not ready, but they wanted to hire individuals with lived experiences, but they didn't have the structure in place to adequately supervise, support, et cetera. We started building infrastructure, whether it was fidelity measurement tools. We started to create accreditation standards so that there was quality in the work. They would have this list of digital tools that we enabled them with. We even created something with recovery on demand. So you could go through our Peerfinity platform and log in and you can type. You know how you do in ChatGPT where you can type in a topic? Before ChatGPT, we created a system where you could go in and you could type depression or just lost my brother. And in that topic, you would hear from recorded video, peer recovery specialists and coaches telling you how they navigated without relapsing. I got diagnosed with diabetes when I was 10. At 10 years old, I show up in an ER with my mom. I remember this lady who drew my blood. She said, I'm a diabetic. I've had diabetes since I was a teenager. And she said, I live a great life. Your blood sugar is really high. The doctor's going to talk to you, but I want you to not be scared. And I trusted this lady. I didn't know her from Adam's Eve, but I knew she knew whatever it is that I was going to hear. She knew about it already. So I walk into the office with the doctor, my mom sitting there. I've never seen my mother cry a day in her life. She looks concerned, but I can't discern it. But I hear the doctor say, if you wouldn't have brought her in here, she would have died in 3 days. Fast forward, I'm in Hawaii and I see this little girl. Now, the technology has advanced and I'm grateful for whoever created all this tech to treat diabetics, right? I have something that's in my arm that is a sensor and I also wear an insulin pump. And so I saw this little girl at the beach with her family and she looked like she was about my age when I was diagnosed. And I walked up to her and I said, hey, that's a Dexcom. Her parents could hear me because I wouldn't walk up to a random child and start talking. She could see my arm. I said, yeah, I've had this since I was 10. I knew she was fine. I remember being a 10-year-old. Then I remember my mother's face. And then her mom, she was like, were you able to have kids? I said, yeah, I got three. She said, was it difficult for you to get pregnant? Absolutely not. She said, how's your health? And I'm not offended at all. I'm there to serve because my heart opened up to her because I remember what it was like. Now, you can put that same experience on top of anybody that has a lived experience with recovery, recovery from anything, recovery from war, recovery from addiction. And when you get to share how you overcame and how you survived, it not only empowers you, but it reaches back to the person that's scared. She was tearing up and I was like, it's okay. Your daughter's going to be fine. She's going to be absolutely okay.
We'll be right back. Sober Positive Workplace, a division of Show Up and Stay, is a nonprofit on a mission to help organizations bridge the recovery gap, a space that exists for individuals between healing from a substance and healing their lives. We partner with organizations to build more inclusive environments that reflect an investment in sober positivity and awareness. These organizations are normalizers, pushing back against stigma and doing their part to change the social consciousness. For more information, please visit our website at soberpositiveworkplace.org. Now back to the show.
We in the world of human services and peer recovery falls under human services. You're not a clinician, but you still fall under the scope of human services. We have never been a one-size-fits-all model. So a lot of times we'll go to these things that we call evidence-based practices. We'll go to these EBPs and we'll say, well, this treats depression. This is the best EBP for someone that is struggling with addiction. The problem with that is the research that has been used to get us to that statement has not included a culturally responsive lens. The problem is when you have an oversaturation of one population, unless you state that that EBP is just for that population, then it's misapplied research. I run every morning. And if I go running outside and I'm doing a couple of miles, my shoe size is an 8 in women's. If you give me a size 9 shoe and you say, I know it doesn't fix you, but we're going to stuff tissue in the front of it and then let you run, I can't run at my full pace. It's not because the population cannot do well in recovery. It's just that we put size 10 shoes and stuffed tissue in the front. It is a challenge, though, to say when you're working with someone, don't start with the EBP. Start with a question. That question is, what works for you? I want to build a clinical rapport. If I'm a clinician, if I'm a peer, I want to build a relationship. Whatever rapport I'm trying to build with you, I can't build it on the notion that I know what works for you. We do family-based treatments, and we've asked people to bring in their mom, their dad. But what if I got two moms? One of my best friends, she grew up in the foster care system. When she got married, her father had already passed, and her mother passed when she was a child. But she had three women walk her down the aisle. So we have to ask and not assume that we know what's best for people. And that's called being culturally responsive.
If you've been following the show, one of the things we've talked about is Salesforce and their creation of an internal peer group that grew somewhat organically. I wanted to get Dr. Jordan Alston's suggestions on how an organization would get started setting up an internal peer group of this type.
Yes, it is something that every organization should do, and every organization should build into their budget to do. regardless of what field you're in, what data says is that if you can really nail DEIA, you're going to have better marketing exposures. You'll have better customer service experiences. You'll have more returned and loyal customers. You'll have more community engagement. Overall, it's a business metric. So the same way that we look at revenue as a key performance indicator in a lot of businesses, you also have to look at DEIA as a key performance indicator in any business if you want it to be sustained. I have another group to really focus on DEIA work, and it's called the Equal People Project. We have worked with a number of organizations, and we developed this plan for them that they can implement immediately. And when they implement the plan, we are there to coach them along the way. And part of that coaching is for them to establish a community advisory group. There should be people in your advisory group that has a real stake in your community and in the clients that you serve. Allow them to be a part and have a voice. And I mean, a real meaningful seat at the table. Create a table and create a seat at that table for them. You would start with assessing who you're serving. Not every organization is by definition a service entity. When you mentioned Salesforce, you still serve your employees. And if you don't serve your employees, you're not going to hit your sales numbers anyway. Anybody with a recovery story can tell you that sometimes addiction can get in the way of them being successful in their roles. There's accreditation we actually offer. It's called JUMP, and it's Jordan Universal Measures and Practices. You would start with the organizational foundation. And I say organizational foundation because if you start something and you don't have the right foundations in place, then even though you mean well, you won't end well. A lot of times, unless you just have the internal capacity to do it, you might have to outsource some of that to get the foundation in place. But once the foundation is in place, you start to build your own peer treatment team. You can get people on the job and get them certified as peer recovery coaches and then, you know, create a community inside of your organization. And even if you didn't go all the way of getting them certified, you certainly can at least create a support group. And whether that's virtual or in person or a hybrid combination, it's good to start again with the right foundation. But once that foundation is in place, I feel like that's something that can be self-sustaining by most organizations. Our website is literally www.jordanpeerrecovery.com. We also have a couple of other grant-related programs that entities that want to get people certified, they can either A, become a community partner of ours if it's a community. Then when we have grants and things of that nature that we're using funding, they don't have to pay out of pocket for that. They can just come in as a community partner and be included in the work that we're proposing to whatever the entity is that we're getting funding from.
A big thank you to Dr. Jordan Alston for the time she offered us. I asked her to close us up by sharing information about a project that is near and dear to her heart. This is the work she is doing related to grief.
I do work in that space because of my own lived experience. So I approach it from a peer recovery. My father died in 2018. My grandmother, who was a third parent to me, died in 2020. And then in 2021, my godmother died. And then 2 months later, my brother died. And then within 12 hours, my grandfather died. And at the end of that, I wanted to drink. So I'm a person with a lived experience as well. I wanted to drink and I never picked up the bottle. I started documenting my experiences and saying, okay, I was angry. I went through all of the different emotions that people go through in grief and loss. And I wanted to know how to navigate this as a trained clinician and as a peer recovery coach. I found that a lot of the stuff that was out there, it worked some, but it wasn't what I needed in the moment. I was going through crisis and I needed some real help. And so I started documenting my journey from even, I remember a friend of mine, her mom died a few months after my brother died. And I got into the parking lot thinking I was going to be able to support her. And I hyperventilated in the parking lot, could not breathe. And I said, oh, this is, something's got to give. And so I documented all of that, I mean, videos and all, and started walking people through. I cried out loud and gave permission for people to cry. And so I started recording crying sessions. And I would say, all right, but I'm about to go run it. Go run it with me. I put all of that on demand, and not only mine, but I started documenting other people's lived experiences with grief. That work is at griefandlosscentersofamerica.com.
For more information, please visit our website, soberpositiveworkplace.org or showupandstay.org. This podcast is written, created, and produced by me, Deanne, featuring music from the wickedly talented Katie Hare.